Many years ago, Trish and I were driving. We had Sarah and Dave with us in the car, and they were only little kids at the time, and my sister was with us as well. And when we were driving, we were noticing that my sister was going through a really difficult time in her life. And, you know, she said something that many of us in some time in our life have actually said. She said, "You know what, I really hate life right now. And I really don't know what to do. I just don't know what to do." And there was an amount of frustration with the way that she was saying it. Well, my son Dave was sitting in the back seat with her, and at the time, you know, he was a little kid, so he didn't know the appropriate response to a statement like that. And so what he did is he moved forward on the seat and he put his back just a little bit toward my sister. And so after she said, "I just really don't know what to do," he lifted up his shirt and he said, "Here's something that you can do, Auntie. You can tickle my back." Now, that was, it was inappropriate for the kind of statement that was being made, but actually my sister started to laugh. And it kind of really lightened the mood of our car for a little while. It was a wrong response, but it was also, in one way, it was a great response. And we just started laughing. The whole car started laughing. And for at least a time, it really did help. But then eventually, we were back to the reality of the troubles and disappointments of my sister's life. And that was front and centre again. Imagine if somebody came to me and they wanted, you know, counselling and help in a different, difficult time. And imagine if I just said, "Okay, sit down, let me hear your problem, and you know what, I'll try and figure out if I've got a really good joke for that." I mean, that sounds silly, doesn't it? It's never going to really help anybody's issues. And if a good joke fixed our problems, fixed us, helped us in a really major way, you know what we would do? We would employ Caleb Poe. That kid has amazing jokes. He has really good jokes. So that's who we would employ. But life presents real problems, doesn't it? And we can't avoid them. This world seems to present one after the other. And you know what? It's not only just the problems in life. It's just the general perplexity of life, the complexity of life, the difficulty that it is in understanding life and the nature of life. And where do I find satisfaction and contentment in this life? Sometimes it's just simply life itself. Where is the meaning? Where's the satisfaction? Imagine if you had every possible resource you could want at your fingertips, and then you use those to try and find that satisfaction and that contentment that you really, really need in your life. Imagine if you had every resource and you still came up short. It still didn't give you that real satisfaction, that real contentment. You know, life, as we look around, we often think it's got so much to offer us. And yet, sometimes it just comes up short, doesn't it? It's not really there. And what I want to do today is hear from someone who was in that exact position, who had every single resource at their fingertips, and they came up short. And so let's listen to King Solomon as he talks about this. Look at Ecclesiastes chapter 1. If you open your Bibles with me, please, to verses 12. Ecclesiastes 1, verse 12. And we've had this introduction in the third person, and now we have it in the first person from Solomon. And Solomon says this: "I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. And I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under the sun. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind." You see, today we start hearing from Solomon in the first person. And really, as we're doing that, it sounds very much like a testimony of his life, as we're going to start hearing about all of the experiences and all of the resources that Solomon had at his fingertips. And it's like we're opening up Solomon's journal, or like he's opening up, and like he's gathering us together to read out his own experiences, his own personal thoughts at the end of his life. And you know what? What he reads is not very comfortable for us. It's just like we mentioned last week as we were looking at Ecclesiastes 1. It's like driving on the opposite side of the road, and that's an uncomfortable place for us to be. And so look at how he introduces here in verse 13. He says, I was seeking and searching out by wisdom, so he's seeking and searching out to understand this world. And then he says this, he says, it's an unhappy business. Now, in the original language, that word unhappy, it actually is more like contemptible. It is a really, really serious word. It's a contemptible business. It's an unhappy business trying to understand and work out this life. And just as last week we learned that living under the sun in this Genesis 3 world, we realize we need to look beyond it, don't we? We need to look beyond it and live beyond it. And in the same vein today, I want to put to you what Solomon is going to help us understand by his own experience, is that it's the distaste of this meaningless world under the sun that fuels a taste for us in the all-satisfying Christ. So I'm hoping that that's what we get to see this week. But just like last week, the first thing that we need to do is have Solomon give us this big dose of reality. And his first big dose of reality here in these verses is really helping us understand that we really can't change the nature of this Genesis 3 world that's broken. We really can't change what's broken. If anyone could possibly have an impact on changing the very nature of this world, changing the way that they can find satisfaction and contentment in this world, surely it's going to be Solomon. Because Solomon has every resource at his fingertips, more than just about every other man that we could mention. See, even the Queen of Sheba, if you go to 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 7, the Queen of Sheba, this great queen of the south, heard these amazing things about Solomon. She comes up to see this empire that she was excited to see. Is it really that good? And then she says this in 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 7. But I did not believe the reports until I came, and my own eyes had seen it. And behold, the half was not told me. Your wisdom and prosperity surpass the report that I have heard. See, Solomon was the envy of the world. Solomon had everything he could own, he had every experience he could have, and he had this amazing gift of wisdom that God had given him. Yet still, look at verse 14 here in chapter 1 in Ecclesiastes. Still in verse 14, we read this. He says, I have seen everything that is done under the sun. And behold, all is vanity, a striving after wind. You see, once you do everything and you see everything, trying to make sense of this Genesis 3 world is still like striving after wind. It's like, we've heard of herding cats. Imagine trying to herd the wind. It's impossible to do it, isn't it? And then he says this, he gives this proverb. And this proverb says, what is crooked cannot be made straight. We can't change what's broken. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. You can't change the nature and the outcomes of this Genesis 3 world that we live in. You can't add anything to fix it. You can't do that with these problems in this world. It doesn't matter who you are, because every single human being in this world lives in this world. We're all under the sun together. We're all part of this world. We can only know, we can only reason, we can only experience from that which is under the sun, in the box under the sun. Even Solomon knows that his wisdom is limited. Look at verse 16 in chapter 1. He says, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And in verse 17, he says why wisdom was important. He was discerning between wisdom and folly, right, in this world. And then he shows us the outcome. Once you've understood this wisdom and you've lived a wise life and you've done all of that, and then he says in verse 18, "For in much wisdom is vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow." See, the more he sees this world for what it really is, even in the ability to see what is wise and foolish, the more sorrowful it seems, the sadder it seems. You know what that's like, don't you? When you look around the world and you realise that this is the effect of sin, and this is the Genesis 3 world, and it does seem sad. And I think what he's really saying here is something like this. You know, we could get the greatest philosophers, the most wisest of the world, who create all of their philosophy under the sun, and we could visit them on their deathbeds. You know, Socrates and Plato and Jung and Immanuel Kant and all of these other guys, and you could go and visit them on their deathbeds, and they're looking back and they're assessing everything that they've assessed in their lifetime, and you know what, they're assessing existence and meaning and satisfaction and life as a whole and the greatest of meaning, and you know what, if they're honest with you, if they're really honest and they look back and they see, hey, you know what, we have not changed the nature of this world, they're going to say one word on their deathbed: Hevel. That word that we learned last week, vanity, meaningless. See, to look at this world honestly under the sun, only within that environment of under the sun, we're truly left with sadness, we're truly left with sorrow. Brothers and sisters, no wonder there is sorrow in this world. Actually, Solomon uses the word sorrow and he uses the word madness. No wonder there is madness in this world. Folly in this world. At least that's what Solomon calls it. Solomon looks at it and says, hey, when we can't work things out, we're left with sorrow and madness and folly. That's not what the world calls it. The world calls it things like bipolar, depression, any number of disorders outlined in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Illness. But Solomon says, no wonder there is madness and sorrow. And this is why in verse 13 he says it's an unhappy business. It's a contemptible business, assessing the world. But if you look closely, he also says that it's an unhappy business. Look at verse 13 in chapter 1 again. It's an unhappy business that God has given. God has given, really? God has given us this? This sorrowful circumstance has come from God? Yes. Yes, it is. Not in an unholy way, not in a vindictive way. God is not a mean, vindictive and cruel tormentor. That's not who God is. So what Solomon really is referencing here when he's saying God has given this is God has given the never-ending roundabout of vanity, of Hevel, that is a result of God's righteous judgment on original sin. You see, last week we went back, didn't we, and we had a look at Genesis chapter 3, and we looked at the result of sin after God had created a perfect world, and really it's a description of what Hevel and vanity is. And if you read Genesis 3, if you go back and read it again, you're going to find that God is giving this as a judgment. He says, I will cause enmity between your seed and her seed. Those things are given to us from God as a result of our sin. We're living in a world under God's judgment caused by our sin. So you see, I believe that Solomon is saying that because of our sin, everything under the sun has, our sin makes it worthless and meaningless. And the more we see it, the more sorrowful it is. And so we look for greater meaning. We look for greater satisfaction. Where can I get that satisfaction? Well, the whole of chapter 2 in Ecclesiastes is Solomon trying to do that. It's Solomon trying to find satisfaction in worldly pleasures, him trying to work out everything through his reason and wisdom. And he shows us two big problems with these pursuits in life. And he starts with pleasure. He starts with seeking escape through pleasure. And so as we look at chapter 2, I want to put to you that there is no pleasure in this world, that in this Genesis 3 world, that is satisfying enough. There is no pleasure in this Genesis 3 world that is satisfying enough. Look at the first verse of chapter 2 with me. He says, I said in my heart, now this is in your bulletins, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. It was hevel. It was fruitless. It was futile. That's kind of increasing the realm of the understanding of this word hevel, doesn't it? See, Solomon was trying to escape from the meaningless sorrow and madness of this world through pleasure. He said, come, let me have pleasure. And he had all of the resources that the Queen of Sheba saw to enjoy every category of pleasure that the world had to offer. Now, before we look at this list, there's one caveat that I want to give here. Please note that Solomon is not saying that any pleasure in and of itself is sinful and wrong. He's not talking about that. He's talking about finding our satisfaction, finding our contentment, finding using that pleasure as an escape for the reality of the world. He starts by talking about laughter. Look at what he says. He says, of laughter, it is mad. And of pleasure, what use is it? He's not saying that laughter in and of itself is wrong or sinful. It can be, can't it? We can use humour in a very sinful way, in a hurtful way. But even in Ecclesiastes 3, verse 4, just the next chapter on, Solomon says that there is a time to weep and a time to laugh. There's a time to laugh. In Psalm 126, verse 2, the psalmist actually talks about our mouth being filled with laughter because of the joy that we can have because of the great things that God has done for us. And at the same time, though, in those good circumstances, we can use humour to ridicule people and hurt people, and it can be very sinful, can't it, and crude. And so Solomon looks at all of this and he realises something. When people tell us that in this life, to escape this life, the difficulty of this life, the meaningless that we can't work out in this life, and when people say that laughter is the best medicine, well, Solomon is saying, well, I'm not sure that that's the case. In Proverbs chapter 14, verse 3, it's probably Solomon that wrote this. Even laughter, even in laughter, the heart may ache. And the end of joy may be grief. You know, my son made my sister laugh, didn't he? And all of us in the car. But it was only a short segue in the midst of her ongoing trouble. There is no escape in laughter. Look what he says in verse 3 of chapter 2. He says, there is no true escape in wine. He says, look, he searched in his heart how to cheer his body with wine. But even saying that, he also qualifies it. He also says, oh yes, but he did it still with being guided in wisdom. So I would say that it seems that he's saying, hey, I used wine, but in a very wise and careful way. Now, look, this sermon is not about the conscience issues related to alcohol. That's not what I'm using this sermon for. And Solomon's purpose, by the way, here is not to condemn wine. It's not to condemn laughter or pleasure. Actually, in Ecclesiastes verse 9, chapter 9, verse 7, he says this. He says, go eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already approved what you do. He does seem to put a caveat there about using it with wisdom. But we are able to enjoy the things of life as long as we enjoy them the right way, as long as we enjoy them to the glory of God. Now, the point that Solomon is making is that they are not our avenue of escaping the meaningless nature of the Genesis 3 world that we live in. They won't fulfill us. They won't give us satisfaction. We could spend so much more time assessing every single one of these pleasures that we have in these first 11 verses of chapter 2. And look, this week, brothers and sisters, I suggest that you go back, you have a look very, very carefully through this list and consider, you know, are these areas that I am trying to put my hope in for satisfaction, for escape from this world. But let's just give a quick overview. Let's just look at the basic categories that Solomon has here. We've looked at laughter, we've looked at wine or substance. In verse 4, our great achievements. He talks about great buildings. Our achievements don't change the nature of this Genesis world to bring us satisfying pleasure. In verse 5 and 6, we have the love of nature. He wants to get out into creation and make pools and beautiful gardens and all of those wonderful, wonderful blessings that nature can bring. But they will not change the nature of this world. Enjoying nature will not change the basic nature of the Genesis 3 world, and it won't bring us satisfying, eternally satisfying pleasure. In verse 7, our possessions will not bring us satisfying pleasure. And in these possessions, by the way, note that he's actually talking about people here, slaves, even though it's not the type of slavery in the man-stealing slavery of America's past. It's still showing the sad reality of indenture and ownership of people. And he also puts it against having large herds of stock of animals. I think, you know, you could look at this and say he had what is equivalent to the Fortune 500 company today. Great success and income earning. In verse 8, he has great riches, beautiful things, gold and silver he can put on his mantelpiece, art and entertainment, people singing. And then how on earth could we have a list of pleasures that people try to use to escape this world without having sex there? And it's written there. And if you think that brings you satisfaction, if you think that pleasure is going to give you an escape from life, well, you'll never understand it like Solomon, who had 700 wives and 300 concubines. You see, art and entertainment, sex, they can never bring us satisfying pleasure as an escape from reality. And then look at verse 9. So Solomon became great. Great in the eyes of man, great in the eyes of all that could see him, like the Queen of Sheba. Solomon became great and surpassed all who were before him. He had all the affirmation that he wanted, all the attention and respect that he wanted, having the power to have everything at his fingertips and great wisdom. How many humans would seriously look at this list in these 11 verses in chapter 2, how many humans would look at it and not say, I want that? That life, if I only had that life, look at how everything that he had, that would totally just satisfy every desire of my heart. Imagine being able to say what Solomon said in the first half of verse 10. Look at it. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. And I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. But you know, we can't read that without reading that last little bit of verse 10 and going into verse 11. Because in that last little bit of verse 10, he says, and this was my reward for all my toil. This was my reward for all my toil. Now, if you don't read verse 11, you might not truly understand that is actually a negative comment. See, what he's really saying here in this last bit of verse 10 is, you know, this was my reward for all my toil. He's saying pleasure is its own reward. Pleasure is its own reward. Look at what he says in verse 11. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Once all of those pleasures were done, they were gone. Each pleasure in itself was its own reward, and there was no ongoing satisfaction from it. It was done. Everybody in our church needs to have that as a wall hanging in our home, just to remind ourselves when we're trying to pursue something and the importance and the priority that we're giving it in our life, we should just remember, hey, listen, every pleasure is its own reward. Every pleasure is its own reward. There's nothing more. There's no more satisfaction in them than that. We need to remember how superficial all the pleasures of this life are. So often we come down so hard on one particular pleasure, you know, like sex or alcohol, you know, drugs and things like that, that people go after for escape. And so often we come down hard on it. But look at what Solomon's doing. Every single one here, all of the success, everything that he's listed here, there is no pleasure in this world satisfying enough. None. And so you revert to wisdom. Well, I want to live a wise and good life. And Solomon would say, in this Genesis 3 world, there is no wisdom under the sun that is wise enough. Just like pleasures, Solomon is not saying that wisdom is a bad thing. It's a good thing. We want wisdom. Wisdom is great. Wisdom helps us direct us away from folly. It directs us away from madness. And in verse 13, Solomon says that there is actually more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than darkness. We want to be people who walk with eyes in our head and walk on a path of light, not on a path of darkness. We want to live wise and good lives. We want to avoid the folly of life. Solomon, in the Proverbs, you hear him over and over again, even pleading with his son. He says, my son, listen to me. My son, listen to me. And he's trying to keep him away from folly and keep him on the road of wisdom. And you can go to the book of James in the New Testament, James 1:5. And if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. Wisdom is a really good thing. But there's also a reality in this world. Even when it comes to wisdom in this world alone will not solve our biggest problem, the problem of life. And so we can be wise, just like Solomon. We can avoid addiction to drunkenness. We can make good financial decisions. We can, you know, live a life that we can give good advice to others. We can be respected for our wisdom. And then we get to Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 15, and we still read this. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will also happen to me. To me. What do you think that is? I think he's saying my wisdom cannot help me to cheat death. My wisdom cannot solve my biggest problem. So why then have I been so very wise? In other words, what's the point of showing wisdom to live a good life in this world now? And I said in my heart that this is also vanity. Even being wise doesn't save us from the dissatisfaction of the nature of the Genesis 3 world as we live in it and reason in it. Let me give you an example in our time. I've been waiting actually to give this example in our church because there's been a man that has gained incredible popularity in our time as a man who people see as a great wise man. He has a huge reputation for this. Millions of people are listening to him. His name is Jordan Peterson. He's a Canadian professor of psychology. I've listened to hours of Jordan Peterson. So many young men particularly have followed Jordan Peterson. Many of them have left the church and followed Jordan Peterson. And he seems to stand strongly for things that we would say that's good. You know, he stands strongly for masculinity. That's great. He has a rhetoric that stands against the egalitarian political correctness of our day. And he sounds wise and he sounds authoritative. He draws from all of the great philosophical thinkers from, you know, Jung and Nietzsche and Kant and Socrates and Plato. And sometimes he even quotes the Bible. And among his many books and videos, he's written this one about 12 rules for life. How do you have that great life? How do you really live this life with purpose? And so he writes it now. He wouldn't like, you know, somebody just bringing his work down to one simple statement. And you can't really. But realistically, what I see of what he's saying is, you know, life is giving you great purpose when you can overcome your greatest burden, and in overcoming that greatest burden, you are able to live solidly with a continual improvement of self. And you keep on improving yourself by a right standard. And I would always say, okay, well, what's that right standard? Whose standard? And what level of never-ending improvement could I possibly be satisfied with when I know I can never reach perfection? See, that's all there is for Jordan Peterson in life. And so if Solomon today were listening to Jordan Peterson, he would just say one word. He would say, vanity. So where does Hevel, where does all this lead? Well, let me give you some truly satisfying Solomonic wisdom. We can hate the Genesis 3 nature of this life. Listen to how I just said that, because I'm going to simplify it and say we can hate life to love Christ. We can hate the Genesis 3 nature of life to love Christ. See, when you hear those sorts of words, they're not comfortable, are they? They're, you know, hate life? Who wants to hear a preacher stand up to him and say, so I hated life? Who wants to hear that from the pulpit? But this is Solomon's conclusion. This is where Solomon comes to in verse 17. Look at it. He says, so, as a result of all of this, I hated life. Because what is done under the sun was grievous to me. For all that is vanity, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. See, Solomon is not the first person to speak like this in the Bible either. You know, we know that Job had a terrible time where he was facing the reality of life. And in Job chapter 3, verse 2 and 3, he says this, let the day perish on which I was born and the night that said a man is conceived. Job was living in a terrible, tragic situation that really had him facing the reality of life under the sun. What is life like under the sun? And he says, you know what, let it be done. I think we're a little scared to talk like this. Well, it needs a lot of definition and disclaimer around it, but I think we're a little scared to talk like this because we've heard so many statements of people, you know, just reducing everything to I hate life, and we worry about whether they're going to do harm to themselves. We've heard it in the context of suicide and depression in our world, haven't we? And it's uncomfortable language. But we have to understand reality. And that's what Solomon gives us in Ecclesiastes, reality. You know, last week we said that our contentment in life that we can have is when we're able to look beyond the sun, when we don't just live under the sun, but we live and look beyond the sun. And Solomon is saying something very, very similar to that here. He's saying that it's the distaste in this meaninglessness of the Genesis 3 world that has us seeking comfort from something beyond it. But we tend to want to sanitize our statements in this world, even when it's reality, don't we? You know, we don't want to say, I hate this life that I have in this Genesis 3 world. I hate this Genesis 3 world nature of life. We don't want to say that. And Solomon just says it this way. He says, so I hated life. We'd much rather say this. We'd much rather say, they're there. Things will get better. Things will get better. Now, it's not so bad. The problem we have with hearing these difficult words of hating life is that it's mostly said out of bitterness. That's the difference. It's not said in a biblical, mature way. It's said out of bitterness. And when we don't get what we want in this world, I hate life because I'm not getting what I want. That's not what Solomon is doing here. Solomon is not just maliciously saying, I hate life because I don't get what I want. Solomon is not saying what he's saying out of some misdirected bitterness, but neither is he diminishing the reality of life by pointlessly saying that things will get better. He's saying that he absolutely, positively hates the groan of the nature of this Genesis 3 world. And look at verse 18. He says that he hates all his pointless toil that tries to escape it in his life. And it's completely powerless to change this world. Brothers and sisters, this is the reality for human beings. And I hate the fallen nature of sin. I want you to hear this. I hate the fallen nature of this sin-cursed world and all the hardships that it brings. And that's an absolute reality. John Richard, my dear brother, can you hear me for a moment? I know that I've said to you, I've sat in front of John Richard, we've talked together, and I know that I've said, we can be thankful for our suffering. Because you know what our suffering does? It brings us closer to God. We seek to trust him more. It grows our character. We become more like Jesus. We can be thankful even for that, right? That's very, very true. But at the same time, I want you to know without any hesitation in me, hear me, I hate the groan of sickness and pain in this Genesis 3 world. Sheila and Regina, I hate the groan of deterioration of eyes and organs in this Genesis 3 world. Charles, I hate the groan of cancer in this Genesis 3 world. Lauren, I hate the groan of debilitating accidents in this Genesis 3 world. For so many others of you, I hate the groan of illness and allergies and loneliness and relationship problems and divorce in this Genesis 3 world. I hated losing my father. I hated losing my mother. I hated losing my brother. I hate the groan. Many of you are the same way. I hate the groan of temptation to sin in this Genesis 3 world. I hate tyranny. I hate crime. I hate persecution and injustice in this Genesis 3 world. And I hate the natural disasters and tragedies and pandemics in this Genesis 3 world. And listen to me, most of all, I hate that humanity is at odds with its creator in this Genesis 3 world. Please. Please, when you see all of this, don't tell me. Please don't tell me, brothers and sisters. Don't let us do this. Don't come up to these situations and say, now, it's not so bad. Please don't tell me that. When you know it's much worse than you know. Please don't tell me there. Things will get better. When you know they can't. If I lose a leg, please don't tell me, well, at least you have one good one. If I lose a child, please don't tell me at least you have another. Please don't point me to laughter or wine or art or riches or nature or fame or power as an escape. Please don't, you know, it won't be fixed with a nice walk in the garden, and it won't be reasoned in the greatest wisdom of the 12 steps of Peterson self-improvement. It just won't happen that way. Solomon says, "So I hated life because what is done under the sun was grievous to me." Grievous. Now, I want to tell you a secret. In a biblically mature way, I hope I can tell you that I'm thankful for hating the groan of the nature of the Genesis 3 world in a biblical mature way. I'm thankful for it. It's a good hate. It's okay to have it. If anyone says that they love the fallen nature of this world and all of the meaninglessness in it that is under the sun, all of their hope is in this fallen world. I grieve for them. They hope in hopelessness. No, I'm thankful in hating that groan under the sun, the meaninglessness under the sun, because it has caused me to look beyond it and see what I can really love. See, in hating my own toil and attempts in wisdom and whatever for escapism, I have looked at the all-satisfying wisdom and work of another. We're sinners, you and me. We're living in a world that is judged because of human sin, and our only true everlasting salvation, listen to that word, salvation, not an escape, our only true everlasting salvation can come from the one who subjected this world to futility to start with, the one who has power to judge, who also has power and authority to restore it in hope. We need a better way. We need a better wisdom, not in this Genesis 3 world. We need a true and eternal and better life outside of this Genesis 3 world. Listen, John 14 verses 5 and 6, Thomas said to Jesus, he said, "Lord, we do not know where you're going. How can we know the way?" And listen what Jesus said to him. He said, "I am the way, the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." See, that's the wisdom that we need. The wisdom of the gospel. For God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him will not perish but have everlasting life. There is the wisdom from outside of the son that we need. But here's the issue. Listen to what Paul says about it in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 20 to 25. He says, "Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Where is Jordan Peterson? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews, folly to Greeks, but to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. This is our hope. Christ is our salvation. You know, Jesus said in John 16:33, he said, in this world you will have tribulation. It's okay to hate the nature of this world. That nature is a horrible nature that we have as a result of our sin. But here's what he says, but I, Jesus, for us, has overcome this world. Isn't that precious? Isn't that beautiful? For those who put their faith in Jesus Christ, he has overcome and given satisfaction and meaning and full completion in this world. Listen, in Jesus alone, we have a risen Saviour and a life to love. We have a life to love in Jesus, no matter what happens to you in this world. But let me give the last word to the Apostle Paul, because I think this summarises this beautifully. Because in Philippians chapter 1, verse 21 to 27, Paul said this, for to me, and I hope that's to you as well, I hope this is to all of us, for to me, to live, Christ, to die, gain. And then he says this, if I am to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labour for me. I'm going to live in Christ and it's going to be fruitful labour. Yet which shall I choose? I cannot tell. I am hard pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better. But to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. Convinced of this, I know that I will remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy in the faith, so that in me you may have ample cause to glory in Christ Jesus because of my coming to you again. Only let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or am absent, I may hear of you that you are standing firm in one spirit with one mind, striving side by side for the faith of the gospel. There is the wisdom that we need. I hate life, at least the nature of this Genesis 3 world in that life, to love what is so much better in the Lord Jesus Christ, for now and forever.